There's no consensus on the 97%. There's no consensus on the dangerousness of climate change. There's no consensus on the anthropogenic sole responsibility of the recent warming. There's no consensus on net zero at all.
My guest today is Joanne Marcotte.
I live near the city of Quebec City, its capital. As for the academic background, I was a system architect for financial institutions and government agencies up to 2006. And then in 2007, I got interested in politics, and I examined what the Quebec social democratic system looked like, and I was appalled. So I did a documentary on that, and you can see right then and there that I'm allergic to virtue signaling. So that was nice. The Quiet Illusion, it's called. You can see it on my blog, joannemarcotte.com. And in 2011, people asked me for a sequel. So I did a book, and it's called, in French, Pour en finir avec le gouvernement. In English, it would have been titled Enough with the Nanny State. And then 10 years later, I just wanted to know what's happening in the climate scene for myself. And I've read these beautiful authors, and I did a book. I wasn't supposed to do a book. I was supposed to do some blogs. But then I said, oh, no, this is too important. And I need to tell people what I learned. And it was, the result is this book, Inconvenient Doubts, if you will.
I've been reading that book on Kindle. I'm just curious, how much work did you put in? It looks like hundreds and hundreds of hours. Is that right?
Well, you could now a couple of years of reading and trying to synthesize the whole thing and to make up my mind, okay, who are these people first, to select the good people? Trying to organize the knowledge that I was acquiring. And it took a lot of tests, 3-4 tests to make a table of contents with that I would be proud of, and that could be understandable for people like me who 2 or 3 years ago did not know anything about this. And so I would say a couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic work. I really commend you. I have really enjoyed reading it so far. Excellent work.
Thank you.
So are you ready to fire up your presentation here?
Sure. So that was who I am. why write this book? Well, I was observing a lot of eco anxiety, energy instability in Europe, the enormous cost that we're not talking billions anymore, we're talking trillions. I was learning that there needed to be some transformational change imposed by these unelected agencies somewhere in Europe and the United Nations and the IPCC. That worried me in terms of democratic process. And I did not see the media cover cost-benefit analysis, and that bothered me a lot. So why did I write this book? Seeing more harm than good, I wanted to make up my mind, my own mind. Since I don't trust, I'm not a trusting person towards the media. So I wanted really to read a bit and try to understand the bit of science that's underneath that, all that. And then I needed to share. Very sharing person. So writing is a good tool to share knowledge. So this National Post columnist, Barbara Kay of the National Post, offered me a quote to put on the back of my book. And what she understands is the book is a lucid guided tour of counter conclusions from 4 highly accredited and rational analysts whose database, very important, Dissent, offers welcome light in contrast to emotive alarmist heat. So I was very proud that she offered me that. And these are the sources and inspirations that you could read in my book. I'm really, really, I had real great pleasure in reading these people. They are humanists. They are very preoccupied by the moral aspect of this transformational change that is proposed by the United Nations. And so you have here people that your listeners, of course, know. Michael Schellenberger's Apocalypse Never, Bjorn Lomborg, False Alarm. We have Stephen Koonin, which I also loved, Unsettled, as if the science is unsettled. And there's this Judith Curry that caught me by surprise because I was almost finishing the book. And then this girl comes along, Judith Curry, and she flabbergasted me. I read her book and it was really accessible for me and all these four people I just love, but they talk about other people, you know. So there's Bernie Lewin that wrote on some sort of history of the IPCC, and of course Susan Crawford that you people know and that you received on your podcast, I think. And also mentioned in the book are all these peoples to the right: Richard Benson, William Hopper, Patrick Moore, Ross McKittrick, which I love. He's a National Post columnist, but also a professor and an economist in environmental knowledge. And the Clintel Report, of course, the frozen climate views of the IPCC. Anyways, these are all papers that I wrote, that I read, and that inspired the book. And because the book is essentially a resume of what I get back, what I understand is the science. So what I'll present today, we'll talk about the consensus, because the consensus is where it all started. And we'll talk about the state, as I understand the state of climate science today, net zero, CO2, what it really is alarming. If you want to be alarmed, what really is alarming? And I have a slide on that. And what could be also encouraging in the conclusion. So to get back to this consensus thing, it started in 1992. At the Third Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And the agenda was to establish a United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which entered in force in March 1999. So it's been 30 years that we've been talking about this so-called consensus. And what it was, believe it or not, it was a consensus that had no science to demonstrate, behind which there was no science to demonstrate at the time global warming, no science to confirm its causes, and no science that confirmed its dangerousness. So this was the chapter one of the Bible of the IPCC, if you can call it. And Judith Curry has a beautiful line when she's interviewed by Jordan Peterson. She says, Jordan Peterson is a famous podcaster here in Canada. The political cart was way ahead of the scientific cart from the very beginning. The convention was signed before anything was confirmed scientifically. So that was my first surprise. Okay. So no science here in 1992. Okay. And this figure of 97%, that supposedly 97% of scientists agree that climate change is due to human activity. Now, people need to know that, well, I didn't. It was totally fabricated. It came from a paper by a cook person, and his name is Cook. And it comes from 2013, where the guy analyzes 12,000 about climate-related papers published between, let's say, 91 and 2011. And he categorized the studies as either endorsing, rejecting, or having no opinion. The thing is, 66% of these abstracts noted that they had no opinion. So he put that aside. This is amazing. This is supposed to be a scientist, right? He put that aside and he said, okay, I'll work with the 33%. And among them, well, there is 97% of the abstracts that mention that global warming is anthropogenic. Okay, so that got quite a buzz because the president at the time, Barack Obama, tweeted that in 2012. And so this is another quote of Judith Curry. It was an example of consensus entrepreneurship. I just love this expression. I just love this expression, consensus in entrepreneurship. It seems to me that we're inundated, you know, we're drowning in consensus and entrepreneurship. Anyway, but, and she continues, but 97% is of a subset of abstracts cannot be interpreted as 97% of scientists. Of course, you and me, we understand that, right? So, nor did the paper refer to dangerous climate change. So, okay, that was my first, whoa, okay, let's go on. So at the time of the summit, this is a quote by Bernie Lewin, which I need to share because it's so delicious. And the quote is, it goes as follows. The IPCC's dilemma at the time was this. It could not yet say scientifically what was dangerous anthropogenic interference because as yet it had no scientific confirmation of any interference at all. Now, this is sweet. In the meantime, the nations could choose to act without waiting for the science to catch up, which was entirely up to them. But this would be a political decision. And there we see the political... the political aspect of the IPCC, which is for Bolin, the author's report was Bolin at the time, without a shift in the science to answer this question of what is dangerous, would be to step into the political. So that was 1992, no science there. Since then, still no consensus on the dangerousness of global warming, and chapter 3 and 4 in the book, you get out of that it's very difficult for the IPCC still to link dangerousness with global warming. In fact, more CO2, and that is something that we do not talk about enough, more CO2 could be seen as a good thing for plants, for biodiversity. And for me, this is me speaking there, the last point here. For me, what is dangerous is the recklessness of the media that amplify alarmist claims of the IPCC and the Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the result of CO2 mitigation policies. That is dangerous to me, to recklessly undercover the benefits of CO2 and to amplify the alarmist claims. Now, talking about good things, there's this graph on the, wait a minute, I can't see, I'll just move you to the left corner of my screen. It comes from the NASA Earth Observatory in February 2020. Now, what you see here are green areas and brown areas. Now, is it dangerous? No, the planet is greening. Now, where you see green is not where it is green. It is where it is greening. Good difference, big difference. And so more CO2 is beneficial for nature. Additional CO2 in the air is good for plant growth. It is also good for agriculture, increasing the yields. Now, this is something we do not talk about enough again. And so is global warming dangerous? Another graph here taken from False Alarm, Bjorn Lomborg's False Alarm. And you see here that climate-related, and how could you measure dangerousness, right? You see, I'll take deaths. And if you do that, you can reassure yourself because climate-related deaths have plummeted by 96% since 1920, right? And if you talk about dangerousness of the climate change and warming, why not talk of dangerousness of cold temperatures? Because, and this another thing that amazed me, there's this study globally, more than 5 million deaths per year are associated with non-optimal temperatures. But guess what? 90% were cold-related deaths. Now, I haven't read that in the media, not at all. So still, beware. We need to beware, okay? Now, this is the fun part, because the consensus seems to be that 100% or mainly the main factor in global warming is anthropogenic, right? Now, man-made. And these following graphs are fun because we can see the left graph illustrates the global sea level over 400,000 years. And you can see the variations over 100,000 year periods. And it's fun because we could see at the end of this graph right here, at the end, very end, where it, you know, it goes up. And we're probably near the very up or the end of the of this phase. But you could see that it varies. And at the second graph to the right, you can see what is happening in terms of sea level from 22,000 years ago. And what's nice here is to see that when it warms really fast, and then whoops, more or less stable. So sea level has risen by about 400 feet 22,000 years ago, first very rapidly until about 7,000 years ago, when the rate of rise slowed dramatically. So there is climate change. I mean, it's indisputable. Climate change exists. It's indisputable. But still, is it essentially man-made? So that's the question. Here is a graph on the second slide. Here's a graph that from which we could learn a lot also. It is a graph that represents what's happening since 4,000 years ago. It is taken from the site CO2 Coalition website, really nice site that educates people on the role of CO2. And the real debate is here. And we cannot say, we really can't say that there is consensus on this, because there is debate. There are alarmists out there. There are realists out there. There are CO2 lovers out there. I mean, there's just a community of scientists. I'm not saying people like me. A real scientist that love, detest, are realists in matters of CO2. So the question is the recent warming period we are experiencing exceptional and easily caused by human, caused by human activities? So the alarmists would say, yes, the planet is boiling. There is an existential crisis. CO2 is the control knob of the climate. Simple. We are the bad guys. And let's attack CO2 and get rid of this. Realists say no. This is not an exceptional period, and CO2 has an insignificant, if not a very modest, Kunin uses this expression, very modest influence on the climate. So, and significant warming periods, as we can see on the graph on the left, have occurred in the past. And in the past, when you see the Minoan warming period and the Roman period, you could see that these were periods that humanity had flourished. I mean, they were nice civilizations in those periods. And you could also reason that you cannot blame the CO2 for these periods where there was significant climate warming, right? So visually, this graph, which would not be accepted by Michael Mann, of course, because anyway, fermeture de parenthèse. I'll close this parenthesis for now. So that this is another thing. So there is the lesson here is that there is debate. There is no consensus on the anthropogenic cause, essentially, of global warming. So the debate is not settled. Stephen Koonin says until, and this is the most important part, I think, of most important lesson that I learned is that you need to assess that, to be so sure that anthropogenic causes is the number one, if not the essential cause of global warming, you need to untangle natural versus human influences. And that is a big problem. It's a big problem. It's very, very difficult to do. So Koonin says, until we can assess all other natural influences on the climate, we cannot for sure assess the importance of human influence. It makes sense, doesn't it? The question is, okay, can we assess all other natural influences of the climate? The answer is no. It's really complex. And Judith Curry adds to that, the climate system is a long, non-linear, complex, and poorly understood in theory. In fact, the fact that global temperatures have increased since 1860, because they have increased, and that humans have been adding CO2 in the atmosphere does not answer the question to what extent CO2 and other human-caused emissions have dominated over natural climate variability as a cause of recent warming. So this is where the debate is. This is where people are intimidated and call deniers. And this is where, if you mention that, you're a denier, climate denier. That's too bad because that's not science. And anyway, that's not how I perceive science should be. And so you have on the right of this slide, if you wonder what these natural phenomena are, I mean, there are a lot, and there's a lot of unknowns, and there's a lot of unknown unknowns. I love that expression when I read it. There are things that we don't know. I mean, we're minuscule in this universe, right? And so variations in solar activity, the Milankovitch cycles, aerosols, clouds, water vapor, you name it. I mean, these natural phenomena are not insignificant. That's science is not settled. The lesson is science is not settled. And I saw that you tweeted yesterday this graph and I'm stealing your line here because I found it so good. And this is a graph that is in Koonin's Unsettled. It illustrates the Colorado River flow over 1,200 years, reconstructed, of course. And you can see where the arrows are, that there was significant drought in the past that lasted many years. And your quote on Twitter was, "Spot the CO2 induced drought crisis." So where can we say CO2 influenced the drought crisis in the year, let's say, 900, 1200, 1600? Difficult, right? So, but still, you can see how the press treats this sort of information. In May 2023, I quote, "The Colorado River is threatened by over 20 years of drought worsened by global warming." And then this year, "How climate change is projected to alter California flooding." So climate is not weather. We should always remember climate is not weather. Climate is not weather. So when we hear meteorologists on the TV and say, "Ah, my God, this is low," and it's accentuated by global warming. No, climate is not weather. But probably the media people find that clickbaiting is profitable. So let's go with that. Another example, and we're talking here about the relationship of natural variability and climate. We have here a beautiful illustration of the relationship between the AMO oscillation and cyclones. What is AMO? It's the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And what is that? Is that it is the cyclical changes in surface temperature in the North Atlantic Oceans. And we can see here really the relationship between the two. The black line is a 5-year average of the tropical cyclone count. So there's really some people that look at that graph, you'd say, well, yeah, see, sure, when there is a relationship between the two. And again, you could say, spot the CO2-induced influence, you know? So these are illustrations that talk a lot, make it difficult to determine which observed changes in the climate are due to human influence and which are not. That's the lesson here. So, okay, what I get out of the state of climate in reading these books is that climate science is very young and immature. You can see if you follow Judith Curry's or your tweets particularly, you could see that new studies are pouring. Measurement tools are evolving. There's still too many unknowns. Really, what's scandalizing is that is the word accepted, yeah? There is no serious peer review process in the IPCC. There is a lot of cherry picking of studies by the IPCC. Some of them are not even published, if you can believe that. There are a lot of selection of time intervals that confirmed preconceived idea. Roger Pielke has a Substack account, and he delivers the news. He analyzes really closely all this stuff about extreme meteo phenomena and the climate and the warming. And he does a really good job. So this is where I mention him a lot in chapter 3. It's really convincing, really, really convincing. Also, there is a lot of misleading. They do some executive summary reports in the IPCC, and sometimes it doesn't even illustrate what reports have contain. Also, highly political nature of the IPCC, and I was amazed to see that climate science relies so much on computer models. Having worked in, it was unimaginable to me that we could model climate. We can't even model La Bourse financial systems, the financial system. And so, but pretentiously as we are, the human species, we imagine that we could use computer models to predict the future when these computer models cannot reproduce the past. That's funny, isn't it? It cannot reproduce the past. But we are going to rely on these climate models to invest billions and trillions of dollars and and there's this guy, this Richard Toll, one of the authors of the IPCC report in 2013, and he says when he ended his analysis, his report, what he proposed is to say that the worst impacts of climate change are symptoms of underdevelopment and mismanagement. The most dramatic impacts of climate change are really symptoms of mismanagement and poverty, and can be controlled if we had better governance and more development. Now that was not, that didn't go with the boss, the IPCC boss and the United Nations and the UNEP. So it was not, that did not pass the test. And finally, Richard Tull, he did not sign the summary executive. Courageous. I thought he was very courageous to say, you know, that's it. I mean, the alarmist tone was too much for him, and he didn't sign the executive summary of the IPCC in 2012, in 2013. So we are, what, 10 years later? Nothing's changed on that part. So let's go to the net zero. Is everything okay, Tom? Okay. About net zero and CO2. Again, there is a debate. There are all sorts of people. And I didn't put the CO2 lovers in there. I because CO2 lovers are also realists. You know, but they really love CO2. I mean, for them, it's the effect of the adding CO2 in the atmosphere is insignificant. And when I imagine CO2 lovers, I see Patrick Moore in my mind, the founder of Greenpeace, by the way. And so I see him, but still he would not be shy of saying that he's a realist. Anyway, you have two camps here, the alarmists and the realists. So on the part of the alarmist, yeah, the question is, is CO2 mitigation the solution, and is it even possible? So alarmists would say, yes, the planet is boiling. There is an existential crisis, imminent danger of catastrophe. The realists would say, no, this is not an exceptional period. We saw in the graph for precedent. Significant warming periods have occurred in the past. So on the alarmist side, you would have CO2 is the main driver of global warming. CO2 is the control knob of climate. And the realists would say, CO2 is not the main driver of global warming. CO2 has a modest effect on a very complex climate system. Seriously, when I read these contrasts, and there are two others, I cannot understand intelligent people not being, you know, curious and saying, well, seems to me that realists because this climate thing is so complex, and I'm so minuscule in this universe, and the past illustrates the strong variability of climate and natural influences. So, and to say today that humans can control the climate and use CO2 as a control knob is absolutely deranged. I mean, anyway, let's continue. That was another parenthesis. About net zero, what do the alarmists say about net zero? Well, yes, it is possible for 2050. We must rid ourselves from fossil fuels, and it is urgent. Governments must be guided by the 2-degree and the 1.5-degree limits. On the other hand, realists would say, and they admit it quite frankly now, and that's nice that they admit it, it is not possible. It's not possible. It's based on unrealistic assumptions. One of them is that the consumption of energy will plateau. Imagine that. There are many people, many populations around the world that are hungry for energy, but net zero is based on the unrealistic assumption that very soon, there will be a plateau of energy consumption. But they say, there is good reason to migrate to less emitting CO2 sources of energy. Okay. The last thing is, how about climate security? Okay, the alarmists would say climate security should be prioritized at the price of adopting global degrowth policies. But no one, no nuclear and no natural gas. Okay. The last line is where ideology could be seen here. When you say that climate security should be prioritized at the price of adopting global degrowth policies, you are saying that a lot of countries will not have energy because, I mean, they don't want fossil fuels, they don't want nuclear, they don't want natural gas. I personally cannot understand that reasoning. What would the realists say? They're realists, so energy security and global human well-being should be evidently prioritized over climate security. And you have governments right now that are being confronted by their populations. And this is goes nowhere if you deny access to energy to your population. And for the realist, nuclear and natural gas are good alternatives. So that's the big contrast. To say that there is consensus is false, is untrue. There is debate. And personally, I'm joined by the realist. Yeah. If you want to be really alarmed, the dogmatic manner in which the IPCC and world leaders treat the climate science, it's still filled with uncertainties and risk and unknowns. That's scary. I mean, for me, that's scary. I was educated by the nuns when I was young, and religion and all that was really good and fine, I mean, in 1960. But I mean, is science becoming a religion when you cannot contest, when you cannot ask questions, when you cannot doubt? The use of intimidation, that is censorship, and I'm sure that your listeners have a name in their head right now, transforming defamation suits into free speech ones. For example, the Mann versus Stein, the media bias and censorship, is that really science? If you really want to be alarmed, the real threat for me is how very powerful global and non-elected institutions can easily dictate destructive and very costly climate policies to the entire world. Think about that. They were not elected, these people. And that with so little cost-benefit analysis, it's astounding that we let people dictate what is to be our energy policies. Astounding to me. If you want to be alarmed, how climate change offers an escape route for irresponsible governments, because now, of course, everything is due to climate change. They are not responsible of anything. And that's it. I mean, so, and the leniency and complicity of the fourth estate, too busy crying wolf rather than doing its homework. I'm really displeased with the media regarding climate change, really, really displeased. And all of these authors have many pages in their book where they quote titles of article, you know, and they're really disappointed. Another thing you could be alarmed about is how the central banks and investment funds participate in the United Nations transformational change agenda. That scares me also. The industrial cronyism and all these forcings to recuperate a term in climate change science, forcings. may not end well. So if you want to be alarmed, there are full reasons to be alarmed, but it is not CO2. It isn't. So my conclusion, after reading all this, after thinking about it, after talking to these people, some of them, there is no consensus on how important the anthropogenic factor is. On the contrary, there is debate. There's this fierce debate. And that is a good thing. Okay, we're talking about science here. Climate change is not an existential threat to the planet nor to humans. The Clintel report is really instructive in that way. The recent slight warming following a little ice age, remember that? There was a little ice age not too long ago. And so maybe it's not too alarming that there is a slight warming period after that, right? So also the urgency sales pitch of the climate activists denies everyone. Oh, that's another thing. Since it's urgent, I mean, really urgent to come up with a solution, we as citizens, we are denied of having an intelligent, comprehensive, and economically viable solutions. We say, no, don't think about it. Don't think about it. I mean, we're in our right here to impose our solutions, and the solution is CO2 mitigation. About net zero, the outright elimination of fossil fuels is a delusion for the many reasons outlined in the book. CO2 is neither a thermostat nor a control knob that can control Earth's climate. On the moral issue, degrowth is not an option. Degrowth is not an option. And denying developing countries access to cheap, reliable energy is immoral. All these people say the same thing. Jordan Peterson is really inflamed. I don't know if the word exists in English, but inflamed. When he speaks to Kunin, when he speaks to all these people, do the curry, his podcasts were really informative for me. They are appalled. They are appalled about the immoral aspect of degrowth. It's good to know that people can express that freely still. So another thing, time to get back. It is time to get back to basics. When I was little, when you talked about the environment, you talked about clean air, you talked about water and land and taking care of nature's biodiversity. Who is talking about that anymore? No, it's been hijacked. This environment has been hijacked by CO2, by CO2 craze, the CO2 craze. The net zero craze. Adopting adaptation policies and opting for growth and economic development for all, especially poorer countries. That is what we should do. So it's time to take example from the authors. I present in this book humility and great sensibility in front of so much complexity, uncertainties, and risks. When you explore the earth, the climate, and the changes that have occurred over millions of years, if you're sensible to, you can't help but wonder. I mean, you can't help but doubt and want to question, because this is a beautiful science. I mean, I understand scientists that are not quite pleased by how things are going in the scientific community and the bitching and, you know, but that's really sad. Yeah. Anyway, we could be encouraged. I don't want to leave you with a pessimistic outlook. There is an increase in legitimate doubt? You were asking that question to your precedent invitee, Tom, and I think we can see an increase in legitimate doubt. People now take to the street, so governments are squeezed. They must reassess their net zero. We're seeing that, especially in Great Britain, and in Germany. More and more independent studies. I think the IPCC is going to be a challenge. I think personally that we will see competitors, new peer review publishing sites, maybe. A good thing is that somebody like me could access information. Alternative media platforms do a really good job. Your platform, for example, and the IPCC is being challenged. Net zero is being challenged. Clean and renewable energies are being challenged. Are they really clean? Are they really renewable? And I think people are asking for a more realistic transition. And natural gas is recognized by the European Union as a green energy source. And nuclear power is getting more and more acceptable. Anyway, we talk about it more. So. Yeah, I think we need. Yeah, so this was my effort in participating in the on the knowledge front, maybe, or on the reassuring front. There are lessons to be learned while reading these authors. The consensus is very lean. Yes, temperatures have been warming. The burning of fossil fuels have added to the CO2, of course. But other than that, no consensus on some elements of the CO2, of the so-called consensus. There's no consensus on the 97%. There's no consensus on the dangerousness of climate change. There's no consensus on the anthropogenic sole responsibility of the recent warming. There's no consensus on net zero at all. So. That's a lesson I think that we should take up. Humility, to have humility in the face of uncertainties and risk should be the mantra, should be really the mantra of the United Nations and the IPCC. If they want to be useful, intimidation and censorship should stop now. I mean, we're intelligent beings here. Now we could, you know, accept or reject some of what people say. I prefer being confident in people versus big administrative bureaucracies and non-elected officials. This is me. Okay, maybe you're not, but I guess you should be like me because you listen to Tom Nelson's podcast. Another lesson: beware of the grandiose transformational change agenda. It is based on degrowth agenda, immoral for populations that are desperately need of a low cost and reliable energy sources. The people I read, I mean, they use these words: eco-colonialism, eco-imperialism, sustainable poverty, green colonialism, doomsday. All these words that could define this transformational change agenda. It's nothing less than that. Beware of good intentions. I'm allergic to good intentions. I'm a skeptic by nature, and people need to be allergic and to it, especially when there is no cost-benefit analysis. We are owed such exercises by our government. So ask. Doubt is wealthy, is healthy. Skepticism is healthy. Questioning, bringing nuance is healthy. It has nothing to do with denialism. The catchphrase denialism, it's no. Beware of the media. They are activists. They lack curiosity. and understand that this battle, if you can say that, is not between a benevolent left and a super capitalist demonizing right. It's not that at all, because when you see what they try to do, they are not resolving poverty in the world at all. So that was my contribution. Get back to real politics, real politic, and beware. Yeah.
I just want to read some quotes from your book that I had highlighted here. We are just tiny ants in an infinitely large universe and on a planet whose climate is influenced by a multitude of natural phenomena that we barely understand. I think that's well put. Do you have any more to expand on that?
Well, what I would add to that is that anything else of being doubtful and having a curious scientific mind would be presumptuous. It would be presumptuous to say that we understand all this and that we can impose on poor countries a transformational agenda that would deny them the right to low-cost energy, because that's what's happening. Yeah.
Next quote is, you talked about this incident where we were told that the Amazon is the lungs of the earth. And Schellenberger contacted one of the IPCC, I believe, lead authors to ask about that quote. And the author said, quote, "It's bullshit. There's no science behind that. The Amazon produces a lot of oxygen, but it uses the same amount of oxygen through respiration. So it's a wash." That was a high profile thing, right? Lungs of the earth, blah, blah, blah.
The lungs of the earth, the polar bears, extinction, all that is disinformation. It really is, and it does not come from where they tell us this information comes from. It comes from people that have an agenda also. And that story, and I mean, when I talk to I have a girl and two little ones. They're 25 and 21 years old. I mean, my granddaughters. But I said, they're little ones. They're for me, they'll always be little ones. And when I told them that I would write a book, and well, the first thing that came to mind is, yeah, well, what about the polar bears and the Amazon fire? The first thing. And so I wasn't to tell them, no, it's appalling how young people are being disinformed and they suffer eco-anxiety right now. It's immoral. I mean, this, it's junk. When they talk about junk science, that's it. If you want to talk about junk science, that will be great examples.
So you mentioned polar bears. You have another great paragraph about them. You say the real threat to many species is not climate change, according to Lomborg. It's humans. From Lomborg, he says, still today, some 700 polar bears are killed by hunters each year. If we want to help polar bears, why not stop shooting them? He concludes.
Yeah, isn't that a great it makes sense, doesn't it? Right now, I think it has results. Not killing polar bears. I imagine that it helps the species. I mean, and Susan Crockford has a great little book that explains all this, and it was really informative for me. And young people could read that, could read the book. I quoted in my book, I think.
Another quote here from Schellenberger in Apocalypse Never. Quote, anyone who believes climate change could kill billions of people and cause civilizations to collapse might be surprised to discover that none of the IPCC reports contain a single apocalyptic scenario. Nowhere does the IPCC describe developed nations like the United States becoming a, quote, climate hell resembling the Congo. So again, you've done a great job of digging into what everyone else has written and pulling out the great quotes.
Yeah, for Schellenberger to say that, I mean, it's important because it illustrates the difference. What happens to the IPCC report done by the scientists, and then it goes up a layer, and then there's politics involved, and then there's Antonio Guterres that comes out with, okay, the planet is boiling, and we're all, you know, we're all. But that is a really important part. We should denounce that. I mean, I can't understand why climate scientists accept that, and I honor Richard Toll for you know, getting away from signing a summary report that didn't reflect at all what was in the reports or the it goes to say how much you could rely on these summary reports. Yeah, they're very political.
Okay. Yeah, I apologize for wanting to read your entire book into this podcast, but it is excellent work. And I can't believe I didn't know who you were until recently. I'm a little sad about that.
That's okay.
No, I consider myself all plugged in. I'm reading about this stuff all the time. And it's amazing to me that I had not heard of you until recently. And
Well, the book was launched in November last year. I am French Canadian, so the population here knows about it. The mainstream media does not want to know about it, but they received the book nonetheless. But people that know me and they really supported me, so I'm going on these podcasts but this is the first one in English. I mean, I hope there'll be a second, but this is big for me. I mean, launching a podcast in English, maybe it'll help to get the book out there. Yeah.
Okay. So I feel a little better now because maybe it's the problem is I don't speak French, and maybe that's why. That's probably is why. Okay.
Maybe.
Another highlight here. Lomborg illustrates the rising cost phenomenon with a hurricane that hit Miami in 1940, reaching 24,000 homes. Today, the same hurricane would hit more than 1 million homes. This whole idea of, oh, no, there's more damage now. The hurricanes must be worse now. Not true, right?
Yeah. Right. Not true. And this is where Bjorn Lomborg and Pekel worked together in saying that you cannot use cost explosion, explosive costs of climate-related damage, because when you consider when you take into account all what is calculated in that use, you can see that the costs are going down. So again, you have to deprogram what you're being told or what you're told by the media.
All right.
There's nothing but numbers to do the job.
I'll just include one last nugget here, and then people have to read the rest of your book to get all the rest of them here. You have a table here listing events and detection and attribution, like tropical cyclones. No detection, no attribution to humans. Extratropical cyclones, hurricanes, tornadoes, winter storms, hail, extreme winds are all listed here. And then you say, admit that you are surprised that there is neither detection of a change nor attribution to human activity for all of these events listed. I think that is incredibly key that you've made a table about that. And for us to panic over...
This is Pekel speaking. This is Pielke speaking on his Substack. I read all that he did in the last few years on climate and his readings of how he interprets the IPCC reports. He's a really good teacher, this one. And they're all good teachers, by the way. And they're all good teachers because I could understand them and I have no background in climatology. So this is a great compliment that I thank them. I thank them a lot because I admire very much people that could teach me things and transmit their passion for what they study. And so, if you have, to your listeners, if you have people in your environment that are eco-anxious and they shy away from, I don't know, again, youngsters and, I think my book is accessible to everyone, and it would be a great gift to give them.
Totally,
so that's my gift to you.
Totally agree with that. Any other points you'd like to make here before we wrap up this one for today?
Since you're reading, I'll read you one. Okay. Because people think that it's a left and right battle, right? It's not. So no, this is no longer a left that cares about humanity's well-being, the environment, and all living species. We're dealing here with a new, extremely influential class of activists and upstarts trained for 40 years in the ideology of climate catastrophism. Some call it climatism. Let's call the net zero activists what they are. Radicals who meet with no resistance from political and media elites, who have chosen to be complicit in a display of green virtue rather than do their job. What motivates them has little to do with improving the quality of life of humans and the environment. On the contrary, such an uncompromising vision inevitably leads to an agenda of degrowth and sustainable poverty, renamed transformational change. And this is the world we're designing here. They're designing controls, regulations, green taxes, violation of private property. We have here in Canada, Mr. Justin Trudeau, this new law, C-63, I mean, it's appalling. New monitoring and surveillance bureaucracies, even censorship and public condemnation of people expressing dissenting opinions. This is where the vision promoted by the United Nations and its IPCC is taking us. Degrowth for some, sustainable poverty for others. I choose to reject that.
So this proves that great minds think alike, because I had highlighted that very part. It was in my list of things to bring up here.
Oh, really?
Great stuff. You go on in a couple more paragraphs to say the single goal of eliminating all fossil fuels may be easy to sell to school children, but adults should know that things aren't that simple. Great stuff.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot. I can't thank you enough, Tom. It was really challenging for me because I think in French, right? But the PowerPoint support was really helpful for me. So I hope people liked it.
I'm sure they will. So thank you very much. I hope to have you on again if you have some more time. Thank you very much.